My name is Jeff Sherman. I'm kind of the hunchback being put into the clock tower here at the time and frequency division at NIST these days. And if a theorist especially is looking for something to grab onto, our job in life is to imagine we're standing in the electric field of this passing yellow light wave, this laser. And our job is to try and make that bouncing electric field, which is bouncing at, in this case, 518 terahertz, that's 518 trillion times a second, to try and make that wave as stable in frequency as possible, or to make the coherence length of this laser as long as possible. And the coherence lengths we'll be talking about are sort of like here to the moon, and coherence lengths in the future may be from here to our sun. I'm going to be talking about work not done just by myself. I sort of live in this group nominally, but of a huge number of people working at NIST in time and frequency. So here's something of an acknowledgement slide. And I'm blessed to have several good clock talks precede me. So really, I'll try and speak somewhat orthogonally on, it's not the state of the art, but it's the state of the state, the actual clocks that run the US timescale. And then I'll talk about some recent successes we've had on optical clockworks. Before I start, I'd like to, I love this photo for a variety of reasons, and I think it'd be good to talk about. This is one of the first directors of the, at the time, NIST was called the National Bureau of Standards. It's Edward Condon. And Frank Condon wasn't a guy. Frank Condon was two guys. Condon is the Condon from the Frank Condon factor, the Condon shortly phase convention in quantum mechanics. And here they are with a model of the ammonia molecule. This is the ammonia maser. Maser is a, we've made a word out of an acronym. It's microwave amplification by stimulated emission radiation. And it's a, they could have really called this a microwave oscillator by stimulated emission radiation, but then this device would be called the loser pointer. So it's good that they didn't. There's, I mean, here you can see what's going on. They're scanning over an absorption feature. This is a coil, 8 meter long coil of copper tube. That's where the ammonia vapor actually is. And it's a copper tube because that's the waveguide for the microwave energy. That's the interaction region. But maybe the most important feature of this is that they stuck a clock right in the middle of it. And of course, there's no connection at all between this device and that, which was an electric clock. It just plugged into the wall and used the mains frequency to drive it. But this was on display for a time. It was the nation's first atomic molecular clock. Generals, congressmen, important people were paraded in front of it. And when they were told what it was, this is the nation's first atomic clock. The way I had the story is people would say, oh, they'd find a convenient lull in the conversation to look at their wristwatch, and they'd say, it's right on time. Congratulations, good job, and you've done something wonderful. So, and I bring it up because Condon had actually kind of a fascinating career. In the 70s, he was asked by the Air Force to write a report debunking all the known sightings of UFOs. And for years, he was dogged during the era of McCarthyism. He was dogged for his loyalty was questioned. His security clearance was repeatedly brought up for review. And Carl Sagan actually interviewed him to ask what one of these, what is it like when you're dragged in front of the House Committee on Un-American Activities and asked things? And this is the way Carl Sagan reports what Condon said. He's, one of the committee members would say, Dr. Condon, it says here that you've been at the forefront of a revolutionary movement in physics called quantum mechanics. It strikes this committee that if you could be at the forefront of one movement, you could be at the forefront of another. People were made of sterner stuff back then. I think now the lab, I won't speak for NIST, but lab directors in general seem to compete and distinguish themselves on how much Comic Sans they can use in emails. And Condon is an example of stronger stuff.
You also had an important paper early on in 1920s on the Coulomb penetration in the nuclear.
It's true. He started as a
time,
nuclear.
The same time as gamma, right?
That's right. He was a nuclear physicist. Yes.
What kind of clock was that on the previous slide?
Sorry, this is the ammonia maser. So it was a microwave clock.
Oh, sorry, masers. When were masers were discovered in the 50s, right?
Well, maybe the hydrogen maser, but.
Any maser. Ammonia was the first one to discovered by Thomas.
Just a few spectroscopy, probably. Just microwave. It didn't use laser.
So you're saying this was an absorption feature. Okay, well, maybe so this apparatus was not the maser, but it led to construction of a maser. I apologize. Yeah, that's probably correct. Right, we've moved on from ammonia since, well, a while now. It's been by international treaty that the second is defined in terms of 9 billion some odd periods of oscillation corresponding to the ground state hyperfine splitting in cesium. And they had to add later, there was actually an amendment at later to define it at rest and at a temperature of 0K. And what's still not said is it's on the rotating geoid at sea level, which has to be observed yearly.
But this is not part of the SI definition.
Oh, no?
No.
Okay.
That's for time scales.
Ah, well, but, so the distinction is even more complicated than I imagined. The way this is realized in modern laboratories is in these cesium fountains. Therefore, the cesium atoms are prepared at a very cold temperature, something like 500 nanokelvin, or at least below a microkelvin. And then they're sent on a ballistic trajectory through a microwave cavity where they undergo the Ramsey style interrogation scheme, where you can think of the first pass through the cavity puts the atoms in a superposition state. The next pass through the cavity measures the phase evolution difference between the local oscillator that you hope is on resonance with the atoms and the atomic phase difference between the excited state and the ground state. And if your oscillator is off in frequency, you'll see these fringes. So the job of the experimentalist is to build a feedback loop, as we've heard, to tune the frequency of the local oscillator such that it keeps the atoms interrogated, centered right on that line. April of this year saw NIST commission its second such fountain. It was 10 years in development, and finally we decided to call it official. The most important part of this new apparatus is the nitrogen dewar. The black body shift is not a unique phenomenon to optical clocks. It plagued, at some level, the microwave clocks as well, and at a similar fractional level, it turns out. And maybe you can see that the black body shift in the uncertainty thereof has been shrunk by now surrounding the atoms in an 80 Kelvin environment. But notice the huge magnitude of the second order Zeeman effect. I mean, this has to be measured. This is, and what's left over is the type B part of the uncertainty that sort of won't get any better the more and more they measure it. And this monstrous, the gravitational redshift reflects our decision to put the clock in Boulder, which is a kilometer and a half above sea level. And so, I mean, I think actually the definition of the SI does require gravitational redshifts, but maybe it doesn't require it to be on the rotating geoid, just at mean sea level. So anyway, this shift has to go in.
Yeah, for contribution to time scales, but not necessarily in the second.
To the SI, no? Okay. At any rate, when the splash hit...
I'm confused. The black body shift is so tiny in this table. Is there a good reason for it, right?
This is after surrounding the chamber with an 80 Kelvin environment. Before this, it was a part in 10 to the 15 or so of shift, and that was not known to better than 10%, 5% or something. This is the improved cold black body shift. Okay, so the news hit. NIST has a new atomic clock. The press was favorable or not, depending on your opinion. The real measure is that this was many years in the making. This tracks a comparison of the two fountains at NIST compared with similar fountains at PTB and CIRT. That's the French National Laboratory. And one thing I want to point out is that notice you may see that the black and blue points don't occur as frequently as the others. And that's because these other two standards run more or less quasi-continuously, whereas our standards really don't. They run for 3 weeks at a time, 4 weeks at a time, and then there's long periods of break. That's sort of by design. They're not designed to run as clocks. They run as frequency references. So I wanted to point out that this is not state of the art, but it's what actually drives the US national timescale is not a continuously running cesium fountain, but it's instead a bunch of commercial cesium beam clocks that rely on the sort of original Ramsey scheme where you spin select some ground state atoms and put them, they fly through here at many hundreds of meters per second. And in this, now they receive a superposition pulse here and a readout pulse a few centimeters later, and are read out in a sort of Stern-Gerlach scheme. This is still the technology that runs the US timescale. And a more stable device that is not linked to cesium atoms is the commercial hydrogen maser. Here's an example of one that is designed for a space mission, and I like it because it illustrates 30 years in Maser improvement was generally putting layers of boxes around it. Every time it kind of got a factor of three better. These clocks, I mean, there are 12 of them currently officially in the NIST timescale, but there's sort of 30 in the room, and they're all being intermeasured. This is kind of the atomic unit of measurement of what we do to measure time differences. Each of these clocks synthesize a 5 megahertz output, and to sort of, you don't want to directly look at those 2 5 megahertz outputs on an oscilloscope and look at the time difference. You'll get a better answer by first subtracting most of the 5 megahertz away. So you do this in this so-called dual mixer time difference scheme, whereby now you're sort of looking at the beat note or the phase difference between 2 10 hertz signals. And I wanted to point this out because it's interesting to ask what the analog of this will be in the optical domain. Anyway, this measurement is limited in the sense that after about an hour, you can keep measuring the time difference of the same clock into 2 different channels, and the measurement doesn't get any better. There's flicker phase noise in this measurement system, and it fundamentally limits you just below a picosecond. So if any scheme you're imagining that depends on a picosecond resolve difference in time, you sort of can't do it with conventional electronics. We're going to need to think about something else. This is the blue and the red are supposed to illustrate 2 different systems we have. The official one is still running blue. This red one is a test system that's really not reliable enough, even though it may offer better performance. So anyway, this is how a National Metrology Lab works, or at least my picture of it. We have this ensemble of clocks, and we construct digitally what we call a timescale. The timescale is an algorithm that takes all these time difference measurements by several clocks and determines, the assumption is that the most stable clock is the best clock. And by taking sort of n intercomparisons of clocks, you can figure out who's drifting, most likely, who's stable with respect to the ensemble, who's noisy, who's not. And you can figure out an ensemble average frequency and apply that as an offset to one of the clocks. You add an integer number of leap seconds, and that fixes all the problems in the sky, apparently. And you only run the fountains occasionally to see how well the ensemble is doing. And all of this gets reported to the BIPM, that's the international body that coordinates international time. If you have primary frequency reference, you report their observations of the SI second with respect to your lab's UTC. You transmit UTC as best you can, either using a least two-way satellite connection. Actually, ours goes through PTB, which serves as a pivot lab for all of Europe and most of the world, actually. And if you didn't have a standard, a primary frequency reference, the only thing you could to tune your clocks is every month BIPM tells you how bad your clocks are, and then it becomes a game of you try and feed in a correction to make your UTC equal to the world's UTC next month, and you'll see how well you did next month. This is the game. This is how well it works over 30 years. Some of this data is available online. Otherwise, you have to go back into your lab's archives. You can see over 30 years, things have gotten about a factor of 1,000 better. And that now, month to month, all the labs are in sync to plus or minus 5 or 10 nanoseconds. And at present, labs like PTB are doing much better because they have these continuously running cesium fountains. USNO has a mountain of clocks. That's the US Naval Observatory. They're in charge of GPS. They get whatever they want. I want to mention, most people see us not at the picosecond level. Most people see us here at a millisecond. We serve time over the internet. You can open up a terminal and get the time from us right now. You can generally do this in a packet switch network over the internet to a few milliseconds. You can do a factor of maybe 1,000 better if you have a private network. We run a radio station, several radio stations, 2 in Fort Collins and 1 in Hawaii. Maybe the most important one is this guy. It's a really bizarre radio tower. There are 2 towers that transmit 75 kilowatts each. They're phased such to get better east-west coverage. And there's a time code, 1 bit per second, that's modulated on top of that. And mainly the problem with getting, you can get frequency very well from this. Main problem with getting time from this is you don't really know the speed of light delay, and it has huge variation with weather, and where you are next to the nearest mountain or canyon, and day and night variation. If you want nanoseconds and sub-nanoseconds from us, you can have a technique called GPS Common View or Carrier Phase, and I'm going to leave this to tomorrow. We'll have a speaker who knows all about this. If you want picoseconds or fractional frequency measurements down below 10 to the minus 15, you have to be in the building right now. And so this is how the measurement averages down. Both of these average down with the same slope because both clocks are limited in principle by white frequency noise. The accuracy limit is down here somewhere at 10 to the minus 16 or so. So it took the old fountain weeks or up to a month to average down to that level. It may, NIST F2 may average down to that level faster, but I don't know that they've run it so. And here's the dilemma we're faced with, is that in the lab, we can take the ytterbium optical lattice, for example, and compare one lattice to another, and it's just it's a factor of 1,000 better in stability, and where the accuracy limit may lie is a factor of 100 better. So we're in this funny dilemma with respect to official time. You cannot really make any measurements of ytterbium's frequency with respect to the local time scale because it's so much better. This clock, this chart has been paraded around, and I won't say anything about it except I guess some of us are at an age where it's just a miracle when anything gets exponentially better in time. Most things get exponentially worse in time. Here's an example from the children's cereal aisle. Right, so you guys have heard this, so I'll gloss over it. The scheme is we're going to discipline a laser at short time scales to narrow it up, and that makes it an acceptable oscillator to really interrogate atoms at long times. So you can think of that as a fast feedback loop disciplining the laser, locking it to a length standard that's good over short times. Over long times, you interrogate an atom. And to count it out, you need a femtosecond comb. Not much has been said about combs. I was sort of hoping someone else would, but maybe it's sort of a technical device for this audience. So consider that it's really a rigid link between microwave and optical frequencies that can differ by a factor of 100,000. You can transfer stability from one to the other in both directions, or you can use it to bridge two optical frequencies that are so far apart that you wouldn't be able to get a beat note with a simple photodiode. And that's maybe a sufficient explanation. So if I had an infinite time, this would be the outline of the rest of the talk. I'll tell you about cavities and sources of stability to make these oscillators pretty good. I'll then talk about the trapped atom and ion clocks to make them really good over long times, and then talk about how we get time and frequency out of the building and how we do these measurements, some of which has already been discussed by Professor Katori. But we don't have time for most of that. So I'll concentrate on these cavities. So maybe the best cavity going, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this effort by the group at PTB and Junie at Jilla had a part of this. It's a monolithic block of silicon. And the mirrors, I believe, are silicon as well. So they're transmissive in the infrared. So infrared light can get in. And this is the beat note of a laser locked to this cavity and compared with a more standard glass cavity. And you can just see it brings the laser down to this incredibly narrow line width. And really the idea is this is operated cryogenically. We're at the limit of thermomechanical noise. That's the random jittering around of atoms, not due to changing temperature, but even at a constant temperature, it's the Johnson noise of mechanics. And so you have to cool it down. You have to thermally isolate it, treat it very gently. It has to be vibrationally isolated. And the shape here is such that accelerations, especially that come from the floor, don't couple into length changes because length changes translate into precisely where this frequency beat note will be. And this paper, I don't know if it's published yet. It just came out of the archive. And I think it's fantastic work using this laser source. It shows that over long times, this laser, where you assume that the strontium atoms is the reference averaged down like white noise. So this flicker that's left is probably in the laser. And sure, it's starting to random walk, but it's at such a low magnitude that it's really beating the workhorse of time and frequency over 40 years, the hydrogen maser. And if the drift stays low and controlled over this time scale, this is going to be a really useful tool. It's amazing work. And the thermomechanical jitter is now below 10 to the minus 16, which is also amazing. That means I think on average, the length fluctuations in 1 second of bandwidth is now a tenth the width of a proton or something in a cavity this size. It's really incredible. And what's more incredible is that it can get better still. If you ask where else is the noise, you can break it up into the thermomechanical noise in the silicon spacer, the thermomechanical noise in the mirror substrates, that's those little cylinders on top. Sorry, the spacer's in blue, the substrates are black, and the thermomechanical noise in the coatings, which are at this stage a dielectric amorphous material, because that has a low Q, it turns out in this silicon cavity, all the noise remains in the coatings. And now people are thinking about building crystalline coatings that have very high reflectivity. That means the finesse or photon storage time will be very high in these cavities. And we're experimenting with these mirrors at the minute. So are, I imagine, several folks, because it means eliminating what is potentially the dominant source of thermomechanical noise left in these both glass or crystalline silicon cavities. So the cavities can get even better. And this just helps. If your cavity gets better, it means you can interrogate your atoms longer. It means a lower atom line width in observed, and that means higher instability. This is the only way. If you guys want 10 to the minus 18 in 1 second, this will be a prerequisite. I wanted to point out that cavities aren't the only place that you can find stability as a resource. For example, the ion storage group at NIST is storing ions not in an ion trap, but in a crystal. These are europium 3+ ions that are doped into this yttrium orthosilicate crystal. It's at cryogenic temperatures. There's a forbidden transition. I don't even know what the configuration is offhand, but depending on where the dopant lies in this matrix, it can have two different frequencies. They're shifted by whatever crystal electric fields are present. And the interesting thing is that at low temperatures, there's inhomogeneous broadening. Sure, this line is gigahertz broad, but if you come in with a narrow laser, you can burn a hole in it. That is, excite all those atoms that just happen to be inhomogeneously shifted to that frequency. You can make the atoms transparent to that laser light by exciting those atoms to a metastable state. And these holes shown here as absorption, or the lack of absorption dips or transmission peaks, stick around for hours and hours and hours. And they really only get worse as you use them. So you burn lots of them and you design a complicated piece of electronics to dither the laser around and lock to these in some semi-random way. And this is kind of, it may sound crazy, but it's competitive in some sense with some of the optical cavities that are out there. And so it may be an alternative to an optical cavity in short-term stability. Over long terms, you're sensitive to everything. Changing pressures in the cryostat induce strain on the crystal. Strain changes the inhomogeneity, and so it messes up that coherence. You're sensitive to temperature effects. You're sensitive to vibrations. So in the long term, you'll still need an atom, properly trapped atom standard, but you don't necessarily need to slave yourself to a cavity. Let's talk about the high accuracy clocks. Professor Katori gave a great introduction for strontium. You can, from a broad picture overview, ytterbium and strontium are identical. They're bags of protons and electrons, of which the outer two sit in this two electron S, singlet S configuration. I'm from Las Vegas, so I'm attracted to blinking lights in the laboratory. So I'll walk through. This is what we see with our eyes when we do this. First, we trap a magneto-optical trap of atoms on this strong fluorescing transition. The atoms scatter millions of photons per second when they're fluorescing with this resonant blue light. We cool them even more on this slightly forbidden transition in the green. It's an intercombination line. And the Mach gets smaller because it's getting colder. At this point, the atoms are about 10 microkelvin by the time we're done with them. We trap them in a standing wave of light. That's what we call the lattice. For this work, it's a one-dimensional lattice, so the sites are like pancakes. They're strongly confined in this direction. They're only weakly confined along the Gaussian direction of the beam. And here you can see that's the atoms that are trapped in the lattice compared with some green Mott atoms that weren't cold enough to get in there. That's a CCD fluorescence image. Once they're in there, we shine on this light, which, if on resonance, will move some of the atoms up into this metastable state that lives for our time scale, it lives forever. So some of the atoms are excited, some are in the ground state, and then the job is to measure how many of each there are. We do so with first asking how many atoms are in the ground state. We fluoresce them, count them, heat them up, drive them away. We then move atoms that are up here back down to the ground state with a repumping transition and repeat the process. There's a third pulse that measures background scatter and other systematics due to the application of this blue light. When they're in this lattice, here you can see this is what happens to the Doppler effect. The atoms aren't not moving completely. They're jittering around. But it turns out the effect of the Lamb-Dickey regime is to take that jittering and move it into motional sidebands. So the jitter frequency of the atoms along the strong direction of confinement is about 75 kilohertz. And that means that in the middle, you could think of this as a motion-free carrier. And you can think of these as the Doppler-induced motional sidebands. So this is a good way to measure how strong your trap is. And the asymmetry here is due to the atom's temperature. If you zoom right in on that carrier, you can see a feature as narrow as the inverse of the time that you'd like to try and measure it. And in the lattice I built, the lifetime here can be as long as 1.5 seconds is our 1/e time. So we can have subhertz lines. And now the job is the same as the guys trying to lock to a Ramsey fringe in the cesium clock. We dither around the laser frequency to see how well centered we are in this line. We have two systems. They share the same clock laser, but we can independently apply corrections that account for maybe the atoms have different opinions as to what the proper yellow frequency is. And this is how it goes. You measure the red and the black are each of the system's idea of what the yellow frequency is. So here the yellow laser is random walking around. We're watching the glass grow, you might say. This is about an hour's worth of data. And it gets interesting when you take the difference between the red and the black curve, you're left with a sort of instantaneous difference frequency between the two atomic systems. Although these spectroscopy cycles are not synchronized, which is a technical point I should mention. That means you also see a full measure of the laser noise. And one night we got greedy and decided to see how long we could run this. And I'll tell you that 90,000 seconds is about enough time to watch all three seasons of Arrested Development. When you Allen deviate that data, you find that it is white frequency noise all the way down. There's what's technically known as a servo bump. We sort of have an attack time to the servo that steers the laser on resonance. And so at short times, there's correlations that are kind of unphysical. It's just that we're not steering the laser as fast as we could be. And then we're applying pretty strong gain. And so you get a little extra noise because the servo is slewing around. You get a brief period where you can average down a little bit faster than root tau, and then it's root tau all the way down. So anyway, at the time, this ended up being a bigger deal than we thought. It got a little bit of press, maybe the best of which was a tweet from Steve Martin, who predicted that it will be an iPhone feature someday. I don't know, from his ears. Not all the press was good. There were comments on CNN telling us it's been a rev. But the best I can take away is I won't share Condon's fate. So I want to emphasize that our progress was not unique. In months it was followed. Our data is reproduced here in red in this Physics Today article. And Jun Yi at JILA months later followed with very similar performance. And now I'll just communicate the difference really in performance between the lattice clocks and the sort of best clock at NIST, which is this single ion aluminum plus clock. It also averages down like white frequency noise, but it's suffering in that it's limited in quantum projection noise by only having one atom to interrogate at a time. We think of our atoms as independent oscillators, and unless you somehow get them strongly correlated, you're going to be limited by shot noise, which goes like the square root of the number of atoms. So this is only stability, but I think there's a strong argument to be said that when you're trying to evaluate your clock's uncertainty, well, we can get down to this level in 10,000 seconds. It's going to take an aluminum ion clock, you know, if this is a factor of 5 worse, it's going to take them a factor of 25 longer to measure their systematics down to the same level. So if you have money to spend, you spend it on stability because you go home earlier. That's the measure. So here's how the uncertainty budget for ytterbium stood in 2009 when we carefully as we could evaluated several systematic uncertainties. A lot of these are so-called type A uncertainties, which means you can take more measurements and learn them more. get them better. So for example, one place we did that is in the density shift. We discovered there's a scheme of spectroscopy. It'd be too much of a technical detail to go into, in that you can identically reduce the density shift to zero, but it comes with a bit of uncertainty in how well you can do it. However, this uncertainty will scale down the more and more you allow yourself to measure the density shift, which really means modulating purposely between high and low density. But really, this guy sticks out like a sore thumb. So it's polarization due to black body photons. And this guy may not be a type A uncertainty. You can't easily change the thermal environment. And even if you can, you'll be limited at some level by how well you can measure it. And the shift is just so big. This is parts in 10 to the 15. It's a few hertz shift. It's comparably sized to strontium. We had to go after it. So this is a story of what you do when you need to go after something like that. This is going to be a short story of what you do. Look, it's equivalent to having a bimetallic strip in a watch that's somehow temperature compensated. It turns out that the aluminum ion, because the electron's deeply buried, has some accidental cancellation and therefore very small black body shift. Ytterbium doesn't. It's a very similar story, except we did not go to cryogenic temperatures. Instead, we decided to measure each of these terms extremely well. We decided to measure this clock's static polarizability. There's about a 2% dynamic correction. And then the last task is to control the thermal environment. So we did it. We built a really good capacitor around the lattice-trapped atoms. That's shown here. It's a transparent electrode and made one of the best transition polarizability measurements anywhere. We went after this dynamic polarizability by noticing it was mostly related to a single dipole matrix element. We decided to measure that matrix element by measuring a decay lifetime. It was a technique executed by Dima Butker and Eugene Commons in 1996. So that's your data point, if you recognize it. Some of it's fine structure. Anyway, it seemed to be some disagreement between data and theory, so we went after it. And the long story short is that our measurements of this polarizability now can determine the black body shift at room temperature to a part in 10 to the 18, if you believe it. The next bit is now we have to get a good black body environment at room temperature. And so the long story short is that we have now a chamber within a chamber. It's littered with precision NIST calibrated platinum resistance temperature devices. We've snuck in this system. We've snuck in the shield around one system. There are heaters tucked in underneath these boron nitride rings. So we were actually able to keep one clock nominally around room temperature, although not precisely known. And we were able to heat the other clock by about 80 degrees Kelvin. So there you can see the stark shift by extra black body photons. And as we ramp that temperature, we see a T to the fourth dependence too. And it's really incredible to... How does that control the temperature? Well, we're not going to control it in practice. We're going to leave it unheated and just measure it to death and hope that it's passively uncoupled from the environment. We'll just record the temperature. We're not going to cryogenic temperatures because with the big shield design that we have, we could attach a refrigerator to it, but our apertures are too large. Too much room temperature light would sneak into it, and the gradients across it would be too big. So it turns out that the uncertainty at room temperature, even though the shift is huge, is comparable to the smaller shift, but the same sized uncertainty at cryogenic temperature. Now, this is just because we didn't design a good cryogenic chamber. But the point is we could operate at cryogenic temperatures. I don't think we have any plans to. Okay, so anyway, Jun Yi was quick to follow, and now he's got a different system where he's just sticking a temperature probe in the environment and directly measuring the influence of black body radiation. There's really no updates to the trapped ion clock, so I'll just say that they're interesting and that they're sensitive to different physics, they're sensitive to different systematic effects, some of which are illustrated here. There's a electric quadrupole coupling to the mercury ion because of this J equals 5 halves D state. And there's some residual motion. This is called micromotion, this little wiggle, even if you can completely remove the so-called secular motion. So this is a picture of what Eckhart was talking about, for example. The aluminum ion clock is too complicated to go into, but it has they've not averaged down to aluminum clocks to this level yet, but this is the projected uncertainty. The aluminum clock has turned lemons into lemonade by observing what happens when you make micromotion bad. You speed up the clock and you see relativistic shift. They've jacked up the table by 30 centimeters and seen a part in 10 to the 17 frequency change. And there's no update to the sensitivity to fine structure constants between the two ion clocks. So anyway, that's the news in Boulder. Thanks. Any questions? Yes.
Can you give like a few second summary of the idea of elimination of the collisional shift?
In 2 seconds? No. The idea is, briefly, that two ytterbium atoms in the ground state turn out, for symmetry reasons, not to have any collisional cross-section. It's dominated by collisions between the ground state atoms and excited state atoms. Excited is a small perturbation. So there's a symmetry there in that it's collisions between a ground and excited. So if you balance the population of ground state atoms and excited state atoms, it turns out that there's no effect. Now, it turns out because excited and excited do collide, you need to prepare not quite a 50-50% mixture, but it turns out it's more like 52 or 53%, and that depends on how tightly you're confining them, because there's some lattice inhomogeneity effects as well. So the point is, though, it's a type A uncertainty. You can try clocks with different densities and see what it is in situ and extrapolate back. So one has a hope and a prayer. What I didn't tell you is this spectroscopy scheme that you need to use makes us more sensitive to mere vibrations and other prosaic effects. And mere vibrations shouldn't be underestimated. A nanometer per second systematic motion, and motions are systematic. We turn off 100 amp current to when we damp our Mott field and the table shakes. A nanometer per second systematic motion is worth 3 × 10^17.
People are going to make it in a small capsule and probably this effect, but is it sort of clear by this, you know, what would be the ideal clock and how you would run it, you know, if you just want to do everything at once?
The systematics are evaluated strictly one at a time, usually until someone says it's a formal evaluation. And no, I'm not sure that it's obvious. We're still figuring out what the weakest link is, I think. We're at a stage where I think it's good to have as many species around, to have as many species in the same laboratory or connected by fiber as possible. Let's make lots of ratio measurements. Let's make lots of comparisons. I think that's what we need to do now.
You can ask, whoever wants, you can ask questions now, but let's go get some coffee.
Let's get back 10 to 5.
Yeah, 20 minutes.
Yes.